This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few years ago, I interviewed Paul Monette after he'd written a very moving memoir about caring for his lover Roger Horowitz as he died of AIDS. They had been together over 10 years. Last September, Monette lost another lover to the disease. I was recently sorry to learn that Monette has been diagnosed with AIDS. In Monette's new memoir, he writes, "Death by AIDS is everywhere around me." But most of Monette's new book is about a time before the epidemic when he was coming of age but couldn't come out of the closet. The book is called Becoming a Man. I found myself thinking back to the opening of his 1988 memoir about his lover's illness. That book began, "I don't know if I will live to finish this. All I know is this, the virus ticks in me. I used up all my optimism keeping my friend alive." I asked Paul Monette how those words sound to him now.
They seem very prophetic to me now. I worried, actually, when I finished that book that people would find them too melodramatic, because I certainly didn't die. And as I have gone on crying in the wilderness about AIDS, I've had many more years since I wrote those words. But it has finally hooked its talons in me, and the last 6 months have been fairly harrowing. What is poignant, Terry, is that I really did have I came back to a level of optimism, I think, a couple of years ago, when I really believed, along with a lot of other AIDS activists, that we were on the brink of turning AIDS into a chronic, manageable illness. That was our phrase, and that was our hope. And it really seemed to be backed up by the excitement in the medical community. That has changed. There's a much more of a sense of darkness and despair, and how hard the long term is going to be in the AIDS activism community now. I think ultimately we will turn this into that chronic manageable illness, but I will not live to see it.
When did you start getting sick?
Well, I was diagnosed, Terry, in mid-December of 91, about 7 or 8 months ago. And I had had fevers over a period of 5 or 6 months. My numbers, that is my T4 helper cells, had been skydiving down in the previous 6 months. And we knew that there was something struggling to break through. It turned out to be a very, very exotic and rare fungus in my blood. And I was given a treatment for it, and I developed an allergy to the treatment that nearly killed me. I think we're beginning to find out. I've now proved allergic to 8 different drugs in the last year and a half, and the AIDS community of doctors is beginning to notice more and more of that, and that's a really crucial subject to try to address. I may have to go into the hospital to try to be desensitized to one of the sulfa drugs. So I was really sick for about a month and a half with that, and unhappily, one of the treatments for this condition that I had, called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, was using steroids. And steroids can induce Kaposi's sarcoma. So I suddenly found myself getting lesions in February and March. And
as a result of the steroids?
Yes. That kind of is a kind of an ignition for KS lesions. I haven't had a lot of trouble with KS since it started. About a month ago, I was about to leave on my book tour for Becoming a Man, and the day before, I decided, I don't know, some old hypochondria told me to have a brain scan because I've been having headaches. Not bad, I'm not a headachey kind of person, but it turned out to be toxoplasmosis, 3 lesions in my brain, so I had to go into the hospital to be treated for that. I look very well, and I feel reasonably well, too. I really do. I mean, depression to the contrary, notwithstanding, one of the irritating things you find when you deal with people with AIDS is that people do not like particularly to hear their friends say, "You look great, you look great." There's something distancing about that, because we can look great and be taking so much medication it would kill a horse, and living in the dread between infections.
Yeah. You've taken care of 2 lovers who died of AIDS. Do you have a lover now to help take care of you?
I do. I've been very fortunate, and I've met a wonderful, strong man who who buried a lover to AIDS about, nearly a year ago now, 8 or 9 months ago. His name is Winston, and, we understand that we're loving in the midst of war and that the bombs could go off at any moment. It's a very difficult position to be in, though. It was difficult enough to care for somebody and to watch them die and to be unsure about when that's going to happen. It's heartbreaking to be in the position of being sick and to watch someone else worry.
Are there times when you look at your lover and see yourself because you've been through this?
Oh, so much. I so much see the a kind of quality of positive denial, whereby he is able to or insists on maintaining a positive attitude about it and me. And that reminds me very much of how I got through with Roger during those 20 months. I felt in a way that that one mistake I had made in treating Roger and in caring for him was that I really hadn't talked much with him about death. And I remember my therapist said to me after Roger died, and I was feeling guilty about that, well, you know, guess what? You would have had a conversation and you would have both decided that death sucked, and that would have been that. I mean, I think that's probably true. I don't know what to say about death, and here I am facing it.
What's one of the most difficult things that you had to do for Roger when he was sick that, you know, your lover has to do for you now? Is there something like that?
Not yet. I actually had to deliver an enormous amount of medication to Roger because he was getting 3 IVs a day, and he was blind at the time, so he couldn't really do it himself. And a nurse came in for one of them, and I picked up 2 of those. And I don't remember that unhappily. It's just that that had to happen for about 6 months. And Winston is now helping me keep my PICC line, my IV line, clean by flushing it for me at night. So that echoes that in the past. And fortunately, I have not as yet lost my peculiar and ravenous appetite, so he hasn't had to be the food Nazi, which is really was one of the difficult things with Roger and Stephen, and a place where a lot of anger gets blown off, I think.
But you had to force them to eat?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
You know so much about AIDS now because you've lost friends and 2 lovers, and you know you've taken care of people. Is it good to be that informed about a disease that you now have, or do you sometimes wish you were a little more ignorant about it?
Well, I have a healthy respect for people who are maybe hip deep in it, who maintain a certain ignorance even as they are. I am the sort of person who wants to know. It may be the writer in me that just has to know. It's very dismaying to sometimes be in a doctor's office and feel I know more than they do. I have very good doctors and very good medical attention available to me, and I'm pretty much I have doctors who will talk straight with me as well. But yeah, I sometimes feel like a lay microbiologist, and all the test tubes have been smashed. I don't know what to do with all the knowledge sometimes. And it's very painful, as Elizabeth Glazer said at the convention, that I have all these medications available to me, and 99.5% of the people who are suffering from HIV infection have none of those drugs available. I mean, even though the drug companies have been scandalously slow in getting drugs to us, and even though the Bush and Reagan governments have been virtually genocidal in keeping treatment from us, we've managed to get it. We've developed an underground to go after that medication. And if you're a person with color or a poor woman, you're not going to get those drugs. They just, you know, you're just going to die.
I'm wondering how much things have changed since Roger was sick. He died, I believe, in 87?
He died in October of 86, Terry, and it's a very good question. The place where we have made real progress is in prophylaxis. That is, in finding drugs that will keep some of the really horrendous infections from taking over.
So you have drugs now that he didn't have access to?
Oh, many, many, many. I mean, I've been on AZT for 4 years, to a point where it really doesn't work for me anymore. But I really had a very long period of time where I was stable because of AZT, I believe. And Roger was the first patient outside of Bethesda to get AZT in 85, and we didn't understand it. We were pouring it out of IV bottles into orange juice. I mean, they hadn't even retooled the factory yet, and I think it gave him 8 or 10 more months of life, though they were difficult months. That's just one example, but there are, you know, we've now found some ways to protect against pneumocystis pneumonia, to protect against toxoplasmosis, which is the one I've got right now. And so maybe 3 or 4 major infections have been challenged by excellent research imaginative application of medication. So that is one small bit of progress.
What about the support system in the community? Is that any stronger or weaker?
It's in a way it's broader, and it breaks your heart to meet people who have been ravaged by AIDS, by losing someone, and to see how many people want to keep fighting because they know that this terrible injustice happened to them. I think that, however, we are burnt out beyond any scale that anyone can really understand. So psychologists have said to me that, you know, we can understand what people feel about grieving over someone who dies, even in a ghastly way, but so many people in the gay community have lost 10 and 20 and 30 friends. Almost everyone I know would say they've lost 100 or 200 people. And it becomes difficult to respond. When Stephen died, I could not cry. I mean, the numbness was worse than the grief. And I'm not sure that the grief, of course the grief came out one way or another, but it wasn't a clean, crying, keening grief at all. That my mother died 2 years ago, and 6 months later I was saying to people, as soon as I have a feeling, I'll let you know. The terrible cost of all this suffering on the heart is that the fear is that it will make the heart dead. I think Holocaust survivors would relate to some of those same issues.
My guest is writer Paul Monette. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Paul Monette. His new book is a memoir called Becoming a Man. His 1988 memoir, Borrowed Time, was about his life with his longtime lover Roger Hurwitz after Hurwitz was diagnosed with AIDS. When your lover Roger died in 86... Did you feel like that was it at all? Do you know ever that like you wouldn't be able to have another lover again because the loss was so great? Or did you feel different than that? Like life is short and you were going to keep your heart open to other people.
I went from the first feeling to the second feeling over a period of about a year and a half. In the months after Roger died, I was crazy. I just was an insane person. I mean, the grief hit me like insanity. I remember thinking that the only reason to get up in the morning was that the dog had to be fed. I mean, I was that close to a kind of inside suicide. And I also had a record to leave. I mean, whatever writerly passion or ego had survived Roger's death, consumed me during the next year as I wrote about him, and that definitely got me through. And I assumed that I would be diagnosed with some horror at any time. But by the time I met Stephen in the summer of 88, I really did feel, just as you said, I felt, I might as well take a chance. What else is there? I've come to believe that, I mean, one of the things I say a lot is that I would rather be remembered for loving well than mm-hmm. writing well. As I said in Borrowed Time, I think that when people come to the end of their lives, as I've watched so many people do, what matters to them is how much they've loved. And, so as they say out here, nobody ever wanted to read one more screenplay on his deathbed. I was open to it. Stephen was less open to it. I had to pursue him, I think, And he said to me when I met him, you know, I have 7 friends who are going to die in the next 6 months. And they did, one after another. And it took a great, great toll on him. And at the end of that 6 months, he was diagnosed himself with KS. But as I said to him, after we'd been together for about a year or a year and a half, it was quite clear to both of us that we were able to be happy despite all the rage and pain we felt, because loving one another was so what we had spent our lives trying to find.
Is it okay for me to ask if you're a lover now as well?
Yes, sure. Winston, as far as we know, is very well and takes care of himself marvelously. I have hope that there are people who are fighting with the virus now, including millions of people in this country. That is a ridiculous figure that is given to us by the CDC week after week after week, that there's 1 million people infected. How can that be? I mean, it's much more likely to be 2 or 3 or 4 million. But I think that many of those people do have the chance to, will have the chance to survive, that some of the new medication will really be dramatic breakthrough medication in 94 and 95. And I hope that Winston will be able to take advantage of that if necessary, and he may survive it. I'm writing a piece for WNET in New York, a fictional AIDS clinical drug trial, a miniseries, about a group of people who come and try a new drug. And I really want to make it clear at the end of that a few of those people may well survive. They may well get 10 or 20 or 30 years.
You have a new memoir, and it's really your coming out story and the story of what your life was like when you had to cover up for who you were and you had to lie a lot before you came out. And you write in that book that every memoir now is a kind of manifesto. Before I ask you to read the opening of your new memoir, Becoming a Man, how sick were you when you were writing this? During how much of the time of writing this were you actually sick?
Fortunately, I was really not sick except for fevers during most of the year that I wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
I had wanted to write it because so many people had said to me about my relationship with Roger that it seemed like the perfect relationship, and they romanticized it a good deal, and as well they might. It was an incredible relationship. But I would often think, God, if anybody really understood the loser and the lost that I was during the 25 years before I met Roger, I probably need to tell them that I was the most, to me anyway, the most unlikely person to find a great love. And that's what spurred me on. What I didn't expect was how difficult it would be to actually confront the past honestly. During the first 50 pages of it, I would think, oh, everyone should do this. This is very exciting. And by the time I reached page 100, I thought, nobody should do this. This is too depressing.
Paul, let me ask you to read the beginning of your new memoir, Becoming a Man.
Okay. It begins with a kind of manifesto, actually. Everybody else had a childhood, for one thing, where they were coaxed and coached and taught all the shorthand. Or that's how it always seemed to me, eavesdropping my way through 25 years, filling in the stories of straight men's lives. First they had their shining boyhood, which made them strong and psyched them up for the leap across the chasm to adolescence, where the real rights of manhood began. I grilled them about it whenever I could, slipping the casual question in while I did their Latin homework for them, sprawled on the lawn at Andover under the reeling elms. And every year they leaped further ahead, leaving me in the dust with all my doors closed and each with a new and better deadbolt. Until I was 25, I was the only man I knew who had no story at all. I'd long since accepted the fact that nothing had ever happened to me, and nothing ever would. That's how the closet feels once you've made your nest in it and learned to call it home. Self-pity becomes your oxygen. 46 now, and dying by inches, I finally see how our lives align at the core, if not in the sorry details. I still shiver with a kind of astonished delight when a gay brother or sister tells of that narrow escape from the coffin world of the closet. Yes, 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 goes a voice in my head. It was just like that for me.
Are you planning on writing a memoir about having AIDS?
I'm in a little bit of crisis these days, wondering what I ought to write. Because I have been very moved by people's response to this autobiographical material, I realize that I have some more autobiography in me, and that maybe I will tackle that. I don't know. I don't want to trivialize anything in my own life, and I'm a little afraid of getting into the firestorms of it. But yes, I've really thought of that. I mean, it came to me the other night that I could write an essay about my dog, Puck. And I thought, my God, you've become a terrible sentimentalist in your old age. But Puck is a kind of figure who really is a bridge figure, who was very close to Roger and very close to Stephen, and he's very close to Winston. And I have a friend who walks around the house when we're away and he's house-sitting for us. He says, I walk around your house saying to Puck, what is the secret of life? And I sometimes feel that my dog has it. So I don't know. I'm still wondering about how to address all that. My opinions are so loud already about the government and the churches that I don't feel an urgency to peg my enemies as I used to in the past.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you the best and good health and so on.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Terry.
Paul Monette's new memoir is called Becoming a Man, Half a Life Story. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.